It's now my pleasure, and I'd ask you to please help me to offer a warm welcome to our stage for JC.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic, and my name is JC. And I was running late this morning. I didn't have any breakfast, and I swallowed this huge thing of coffee down. And I got here, and my heart was just pounding. And now I'm on the other side crashing. But anyway, I want to thank Bill for asking me here. I appreciate the opportunity to be of service. I really enjoyed what Doug had to say about how he uses the various books from the different branches of recovery, 12-step recovery. I really enjoyed listening to Danette. You know, she's got many, many years of very valuable experience. And Ginger, I absolutely loved listening to that. To listen to recovery of an Al-Anon, you know, using the same exact spiritual principles that we in AA and NA have an opportunity to use. And anyway, this is not an AA meeting, so I'm not constrained by the traditions of AA. I'll talk about things a little bit differently, probably. I am an alcoholic and I am an addict, among other things, and I am recovered from both of those. I haven't had to drink or use in over 20 years. I've been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 27 years, so I didn't get this thing right away. And in order to not lose my track, I put my thoughts down on paper. So I'm going to use that as my source today because I have some information I want to put out, and I want to stay on track. I don't want to digress. I know myself. I go off on tangents. And so these are my thoughts, though. I want to touch on steps 8 and 9 from a different angle than our other speakers have done today. You know, rather than talk about the mechanics of what to do or how to do the steps, I want to talk at some depth about why do we do them, you know, which is going to require going into some history, and it's going to require a little bit of your patience. And don't worry, it's a short history. And hopefully I won't be too boring. Let's get started. What I'm going to say is nothing new to people that have been around the recovery, but it's rather a point of emphasis. You know, Bill W., who wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he's the main author, and it's the father book of all the other 12-step recovery books, so I'm probably going to mention that several times. But he got sober in December 14th, 1934. And he was depressed, suicidal, and unable to maintain sobriety, and he was approaching wet brain status. He had been in numerous hospitals, and they basically, you know, counted him as a hopeless condition and was probably going to be permanently institutionalized in a nut house. And that night, December 14th, I would just mention, he hit his bottom. He had been in the hospital a few days before. He hit his bottom, and while he had received a spiritual message from an old drinking buddy of his that had recovered, Evie, he hadn't been able to get sober, and he had been dabbling around the spiritual thing for a month or two or a few weeks. And but that night, December 14th, this is what he said to himself when he hit that bottom, and he hit the bottom. I humbly offered myself to God as I understood him, admitting for the first time that of myself I was nothing. I placed myself under his care and direction. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my new friend take them away, root and branch. That's from page 13 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That's from Bill's story. And he never drank again. He died January 24th, 1971, with 36 years, 1 month, and 10 days of continuous sobriety. And from that humble beginning of complete surrender, new reliance on this power greater than itself. And then AA's official date, the start of all recovery programs in a sense, was June 10th, 1935. And that's when Bill W.'s message produced sobriety in another hopeless drunk, Dr. Bob, who also stayed sober until he died 15 years later. Now, what we're talking here is two very educated men. Bill W. was a guy who had gone through law school, completed law school. He had been a stockbroker in New York City, the center of a stock brokerage, and he had even instituted some changes on the stock market that are still being used today. You know, he had his own little genius in a way. And then Dr. Bob, he was a medical doctor who was a surgeon. And now, so we've got two educated men who had promising futures at some point and who lost control of their drinking and could neither stop nor moderate. But through that early, seemingly primitive spiritual AA message, they both got, they stayed sober the remainder of their lives. Now, there's a miracle in there. Now, both of these guys had been involved in numerous attempts to stay sober. But suddenly they were able to stay sober and to the end of their lives. Now, how did this happen? Now, the answer is twofold. First part is what happened to them. You know, here's the key to that is a real alcoholic, a real drug addict, or anybody else caught in a real obsession is unable to maintain sobriety on self-knowledge and self-will on a permanent basis. That just won't happen. Self-will and self-knowledge will not do it alone. It will not do it. And the flip side of that is the spiritual solution is not a theory. It works. So why do we do all 12 steps? You know, third step is, you know, the second step says God restores the sanity. Third step says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God. Why, well, you know, why doesn't that just work, you know? Well, you know, and especially why do we do steps 8 and 9 and 4? You know, these are really humbling. You know, talking about all the wrongs we did. You know, coming to other people and saying, you know, I'm sorry. This type of stuff. You know, this is humbling. You know, and it goes against our grain of pride and fear and all this kind of stuff. But I want to shed some light on this part of it. You know, for over the past 20 years. I've had the opportunity to work with hundreds of alcoholics and drug addicts, and the vast majority would only give lip service to the first three steps. And they ended up drunk or using again. And once that happened again, they were trapped in that hopeless state of mind and body once again. And many, many of those that I've worked with died or were in accidents or went to prison. You know, I've seen this over and over and over. You know, so what was the problem? What was the problem? Almost all these people did the first three steps. What was the problem? They failed to enlarge their spiritual life. They just cannot hear or see the absolute necessity of seeking the spiritual solution. You know, they just can't see it. I couldn't see it for 7 years. And I went back and went back, you know, and got in more trouble. And by the time I got back here, after being around here, I was really in a pickle. And I want to revisit the chain of events from the pure spiritual perspective leading to Bill's recovery and, of course, to AA. And I'm going to start on pages 26 and 27 of the big book. I want to expand on the little story that's in there, which is all this circular stuff that I'm doing is going to lead back. So there's a method to my madness, and I hope that if I reach one person on the necessity of this, why we do this, you know, I'm a success today. I'm going to expand on the story of Roland H. on pages 26 and 27. And he was this was back in the late 1920s and the early 1930s, before 12 steps were around, when alcoholics were not getting sober. You know, they were just getting institutionalized. Drug addicts were not getting clean. They were just getting institutionalized. Alcoholics were turning into drug addicts. Drug addicts were turning into alcoholics. You know, and they all ended up it all ended up bad. Well, this Roland H. guy, he was a drunk from a wealthy American family. He had it all going on, you know, and he couldn't get sober, and so he decided to go to Europe for psychoanalysis under you know, one of the most famous psychiatrists of the day, a Dr. Carl Jung. And anybody that's familiar with psychiatry, psychology, at that time, the three most famous psychiatrists in the world was Richard Adler, it was Sigmund Freud, who I'm sure everybody's heard of, and Dr. Carl Jung. Dr. Carl Jung was Sigmund Freud's number one student. Now, the reason I mention that is because we are very, very, very lucky that Roland H. went to Dr. Carl Jung and not one of the other two. The reason why is that Sigmund Freud was very anti-religious, spiritual, on any basis. And his student, Carl Jung, had gone a separate way by that time. And he had seen that in history there had been numerous recoveries of people from hopeless states of mind and body through spiritual means that couldn't be affected by anything else. You know, so this, so he saw that something worked behind the scenes. And after repeated failures of Roland H. to get sober, you know, he went back to the doctor and he was told by the doctor a ego-shattering statement that he was hopeless. You know, there was really no hope for him. The only hope was, you know, to find some kind of spiritual release. And you know, and Roland H., being a religious guy, thought, well, you know, well, that's enough. But he, you know, the vital spiritual experience that he needed, you know, he wasn't talking about religious convictions, you know, though they're good. They didn't spell the vital spiritual experience, you know. So Roland H., having been smashed down, seeing that he was hopeless, he was the greatest psychiatrist in the world, couldn't help him. He went back and he joined this group in America called the Oxford Group. And he got sober. The greatest psychiatrist in the world couldn't keep him sober, but he got sober almost immediately in the Oxford Group. Now, why did this not work? Why did this work and not regular religion? You know, well, the Oxford Group, OG, was a non-denominational Christian organization that distilled some simple common principles found in all religions, and that when practiced regularly, they were potent enough to really change lives. And what were these common denominators? You know. Originally was called a First Century Christian Fellowship, and it was founded in 1908 by Frank Buckman, a minister who, having had a powerful spiritual awakening that changed his life, wanted to share his formula with others. So he started this First Century Christian Fellowship, later changing names a couple times, and ended up being the Oxford Group. And this was largely based on the Bible, which is largely based on the Bible's Book of James and the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 5 through 7, that's Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount. Now, the OG message contained the four absolutes of personal conduct. They said absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, absolute honesty, absolute love. And they also placed emphasis on the principles of self-survey, kind of sounds like step 4, confession, kind of sounds like step 5, restitution, sounds like 8 and 9, service, sounds like 12. Prayer and meditation, sounds like step 11. And then they have this practice they call sharing. You know, sounds like something we talk about in 12-step groups. Anyway, I hope it's all starting to sound familiar. A lot of alcoholics were getting sober in this OG group. They weren't getting sober other places. They were going to this OG group, so they were starting to work. And Roland is the guy that helped Eddie, and Eddie's the guy that helped Bill W., the guy that wrote the big book. And Bill W., because Eddie brought in that message, Bill W. has always referred to him as his sponsor. And now, Eddie had been committed to a nut house. This was Bill's lifelong drinking buddy. He was getting committed to a nut house, and Roland got the judge to give him to him, and they gave him these OG principles, and after a few false starts, you know, Eddie was able to get sober. And then he gave it to Bill W. Then after Bill W.'s few dabblings, he got his ego smashed, and he was able to do this thing, you know, that step 1, and then move on, you know, and step 2 and 3. Bill W., he went and met one of the founding leaders of the OG movement in America, a Reverend Sam Shoemaker, an Episcopal minister for the Calvary Church, who was and he taught these principles more so to Bill W. And Bill W. was an avid student, you know, and Bill was an active OG member for 3 years while he was also working with AAers also. And anyway, AA separated from that. But Dr. Bob, once he understood powerlessness and disease concept of alcoholism, he was able to fully give himself to the OG principles and also had the spiritual awakening and retained that permanent sobriety. Now, Dr. Bob, he was a guy who was very religious. He was going to church. He was doing these different things. He was a Bible reader. But he couldn't go overcome it until Bill W. told him, you know, that, hey, you know, you're shot. You've got a hopeless disease. And if self-will and self-knowledge will not do it. You know, and then Dr. Bob was able to completely give himself to the spiritual principles, you know, and it worked for him too. So this is all leading to why do we do what we do? And this was 1935. There was no big book yet. And AAers who had separated from OG after a few years because the alcoholics, they weren't getting along too well with the more religious types. They had some weird characters, and so they felt more comfortable starting their own thing. But they developed a 6-step program. Originally, we didn't have the 12 steps. There was no 8 and 9. 10, 11, 12. There was no 7. You know, we had 6 steps originally. And all the guys that originally were involved in writing that book, they did 6 steps, or they did the OG method. And the 6 steps of early Alcoholics Anonymous was, number 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, just like step 1 today. We got honest with ourselves is 2. 3, we got honest with another person in confidence. Those are like 4 and 5. 4, we made amends for harm done. So those are like 8 and 9. And then 5, we worked with other alcoholics without demand for prestige or money. You know, we do this out of love, you know, and to stay sober and clean, healthy. We prayed to God to help us do these. This is 6. Step 6 was we prayed to God to help us do these things as best we could. And this is what built up AA until Bill wrote the 12 steps in January 39 and expanded 12 steps simply to eliminate wiggle room. You know, knew the tendency of alcoholics and our types to rationalize and try to find a little wiggle room here and not do it. And he wanted to also make a more complete statement that he could talk about further in the book, steps 8 and 9. And so 4 became steps 8 and 9 as we know them. Now, now the first forward, I want to talk about purpose for a second. You know, the grandfather of the 12-step books, in 3 places in that book, it states specifically what its purpose is. You know? And the first foreword of the first edition of the book, which is always in every edition, the first 2 sentences, it says, we at AA are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. To show others precisely how we have recovered. You know? People have been mentioning tonight about getting sponsors and listening to them. The sponsor can show you precisely how he recovered. And hopefully he recovered using this program. That's one purpose. And on page 20 of the book, it also has a purpose. It says, what do I have to do? It asks the question, you know, that's every man's question, every person, every woman's question. What do I have to do? It says, it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. This book will answer your questions. And then on page 44 and 45 of the big book, this gets down to the meat of the matter. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if, when drinking or using or whatever, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We lose our choice. We lose our choice to say no. Lack of power is our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. We have to have a power to live by. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find that power, this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main purpose, its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And it means, of course, we're going to talk about God. You can't get around that subject if you're doing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. That's just part of the deal. The spiritual solution really works, as we said earlier. You know, so what am I saying here that we... what I'm saying here is that we generally see a fairly low rate of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. Probably Al-Anon, too. I'm not as familiar. But we definitely see a very low rate of recovery. Not from the people that actually really try to do the steps, but from the people that come through the doors. We see a low rate of recovery. You know, so... And if you or anyone you're working with is a real alcoholic, the message is there is no middle of the road solution. Either go to the bitter end of a death and destruction, or accept spiritual help. You know, obviously this can be done if we honestly want to and are willing to put in the effort. And I want to emphasize the steps are a design for living, which really works. Of course, one of the purposes of the steps is the destruction of self-centeredness. It's a spiritual disease. Why is it a spiritual disease? Because self-centeredness has separated us. We really are creatures of mind, body, and spirit. And we're separate from that when we're really self-centered. A reversing of the wreckage of our alcoholic self-centered past works in this direction to help us help the release happen. You know, that's steps 8, and that brings me back to the humbling nature of 8 and 9. We often just don't want to do these amends, and we just don't want to see the necessity. You know, our fears, pride, denial, and rationalizations can destroy our efforts if we don't really understand what is truly at stake. What is truly at stake? Why do we really do this? It's the difference between life and death. We can choose life or we can choose death. You know, to live on a God-centered basis rather than a self-centered basis is the only real way in which we can develop and maintain a spiritual condition potent enough to lift our alcoholic obsessions, drug addict obsessions, other obsessions, and free us from the hopeless state of mind and body. It's the only way. It's been so over time. You can't go anywhere else and find large amounts of recovered alcoholics and drug addicts unless you're in 12 steps or in some churches, some church organizations, some church recovery programs. Now, why is this? You know, this is stuff we're talking about is cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful. We're talking about obsessions, which are powerful clusters of thoughts and ideas and knowledge charged with emotional feelings. And these overpower us. The nature of an obsession is they control us and not vice versa. And the main problem of the alcoholic is in his mind. The main problem of the drug addict is in his mind. You know, and the great obsession is somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drug of choice. You know, and there's also the common obsession that after a period of sobriety that we're going to regain control. Doesn't happen. Not if you're a real alcoholic, real drug addict. You know, and they think they're going to beat the game. No, it won't happen. Of course, we also have no effective mental defense against the first drink or the first use. You know, it just doesn't, you know, we find a way to pick up again. And then once we pick up again, we're locked in the obsession of our, you know, the compulsion to use. That phenomenon of craving hits us. We're all familiar with the phenomenon of craving. We get locked in there and there's no getting out of it. You know, and until someone really accepts that there will never be immunity or sobriety or cleanness without going to these extreme lengths that we're talking about, they just won't be, they just won't do the tough follow through that's required in steps like 8 and 9. It takes a tough follow through. You have to really believe you're hopeless. You have to really believe that your choices are stark. And that's why we see low rates of recovery. You know, because a lot of people just, they haven't come to that belief, you know. The question must always be posed to a newcomer is, are you willing to go to any lengths? Are you willing to go to any lengths? You know, now, there's quite a difference between the info in the 12 and 12 and in the big book on steps 8 and 9. And, you know, the 12 and 12 only has like 10 pages total. 10 small pages is only about 250 words per page. You know, so you're not talking about very much information in the 12 and 12. And in the big book, there's only 8 pages. And there's about the same amount of words on a page. So there's not a whole lot of information for steps 8 and 9. You know, a total of 18 pages in those two books, which are the main two books. From AA, and so there's not much from either one, but it's the essence of what's in the two different books that I'm going to discuss. You know, in the big book, or in the big book, there's five during those 8 pages discussing steps 8 and 9. There's 5 prayerful petitions to God for strength and willingness and courage to do this. You know, And then there's like seven mentions of God and a couple of mentions of Creator. I mean, it's a very spiritual process, steps 8 and 9. And the 12 and 12, now there's some great information in the 12 and 12, and I'm not putting down that information. You know, there's some stuff in there that's very illuminating, and it really uncovers a lot of our rationalizations in the 12 and 12. But there's virtually no mention of the spiritual aspect in the 12 and 12. So when I'm working with a newcomer, somebody's going through the steps, we always go through the big book. Because really, this program is about spirit. I'm not going to come here and suddenly become Mr. Wonderful, Mr. Strength. I'm not going to suddenly have the ability of myself to find the courage and strength to do this stuff. You know, that's a hard answer. That's a hard road. You know, but through prayer, we can find the strength to do this stuff. We can find the strength to, and if we don't have willingness, we can pray for willingness, and we can find willingness. It really does work. You know, so let's see. About willingness to go to any length. If you don't have the willingness or enough of it, you can pray for this attribute and receive it. I personally never apologize for believing, depending, relying on God. That has been my source of strength and sobriety. If I have the slightest urge to drink or use or anything, I just ask God to remove it. I don't even say that anymore. All I say is thank you for my sobriety. And I don't fight it at all. I've never had to fight it. It's been taken care of. You know, it's been removed. And I was going to tell a little bit about my personal amends, about my willingness to go to any length, but we're running low on time.
Okay.
First off, I'll mention financial amends for just a minute. Now, it seems kind of, in some ways, some of these people, it seems real easy just to say, you know, I'm sorry. I hope you forgive me. You know, but if you owe them money, you know, I don't cut the mustard. You know, somebody owes me money and they said, hey, I'm in this new program. I'm sorry about screwing you over, you know, and everything. I hope you forgive me. Well, I'm much more willing to forgive them if they got their wallet with them. You know, a lot more. And it looks real to me. I'm not questioning the validity of what's happening with them. You know, are they on a spiritual basis where they're really changing their life? Are they just conning me once again? You know, probably nobody here's a con man. Now, it took me 10 years to complete my financial amends. I owed a lot of money. I told you earlier that I was in here 7 years before I got sober, 7.5 years, around 8A before I stayed sober. Well, I'd gotten sober for about 5 years back in my early 30s. And man, I was a dynamic guy. I started doing stuff. You know, I put together a business. I was going to school. I accrued a lot of money. For the first time in my life, I had credit. And they just kept issuing me the better cards, you know, the platinum, the gold, the diamond, the whatever, you know. And they kept increasing the limits and doing all this kind of stuff. And I'll tell you, when I finally relapsed, I relapsed with a pocket full of plastic and not too much green. And I went out there and I busted it. You know, I did all the things that I wanted to do when I was drinking before and couldn't do because I was limited by money, you know. So I wanted to be Charlie Sheen, you know, but I tried to live like Charlie Sheen, you know, and I ended up being about as sick as he is. but bless the guy. I don't know how I would have ever got sober if I was making $3 million a week, you know. But anyway, I was trying to spend $3 million a week, and I didn't have any income coming in by the end, and I spent it. So it took me 10 years in sobriety to pay off all these amends. I did the best I could, you know, and it was a tough pill to swallow, but everything, you know, life is only comes one day at a time. There's only so much we can do one day. If we can't pay that day, we can't pay that day. And you know, I made deals with people. You know, I made deals with people, and I started paying, and I got all the individual to small things paid off early on, and then I slowly started catching up on child support, and that's a fun one, all the interest, that, you know, and then credit cards and all this kind of stuff. It wasn't fun. And then I had an ex-wife that I owed some serious amends to, and I made amends to her. I said, hey, you know, I'm an AA. I'm sober now. I'm doing better. And I had to do this amends on the phone because she lived in another state. And I said, do you have some time? She said, yeah. I spent about 10, 15 minutes doing my amends to her on the phone. She patiently listened, and she said, are you through? I said, yeah, I'm through. She goes, F you. You are blippity, 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 and boom. And I said, well, I cleaned off my side of the street. But I actually did. I had cleaned off my side of the street as best I could. You know, it's not about whether they forgive us or not. It's about us cleaning up our side of the street. Whatever. Sometimes we don't get the greatest responses. Now, my last amends that I want to mention is when I relapsed after that 5 years of sobriety initially, I relapsed because I was extremely busy. I had been doing the AA program, the 12 steps, and then I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. I got caught up in the material world of school, business, different things, family, and I just kind of quit going to meetings, you know, none of that stuff really mattered, you know, and I was all about me again. And anyway, I was real busy. I wasn't taking care of my wife, and she found somebody to take care of her, and I was pissed. I was pissed. I mean, I was really pissed and hurt, deeply hurt. And when I'm hurt, I'm pissed, you know. And and I didn't have the foundation under me to stay sober. You know, I didn't have any spiritual basis to stay sober. I'd lost all that in going after the material world. And I picked up again with the idea that I was going to, drink away my misery and have fun. F you, you know, I don't care about whatever you did, you know, just do it. But I was really deeply angry. And so I made amends to her after I got sober, finally. And after 9 months, I was able to make amends to her. And I had to make amends to her largely for, because I was cussing her out every time I saw her. I'd go pick up my kid, and I just couldn't not say something, you know, what she was. You know, and y'all know what kind of words I probably used, and I did. And so my sponsor said, you need to make amends to her. Her? You know, and well, I made amends to her, and it worked out good. And then he started talking to me, and he goes, how's that whole relationship going on? I said, it's going real good, except for, you know, that boyfriend of hers that she had the affair with, you know, they're now living together, and they're probably going to get married, and I can't stand that guy, you know. And he goes, well, how do you treat him? Well, every time I saw that guy, every time I went over to pick up my daughter, I gave that guy the evil eye. You know, I usually wanted to wear tank tops when I went over there. Pump up right before I got there, and give him the evil eye, and he's kind of a scrawny guy with a little chicken neck, and I loved that neck, you know, I focused on that neck, and whenever I came over, you know, he kind of averted my eyes, and he'd go find something to do, he'd disappear, you know, and I just love harassment. He says, you owe that guy an amends. My sponsor says, you owe that guy an amends. Wait, this is the guy that had an affair with my wife, broke up my family, stole my wife and kid. He's got them now. I've got, you know, blah, 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 blah. No, it's about you cleaning your side of the street. Ooh. So that didn't sound good at all, but, you know, I thought about it and I thought about it and I prayed about it. I got some willingness and I called over at the house and he picked up the phone and said, hey, this is JC, you know, I need to talk to you because I'm really busy now. I can't really talk right now. And he hung up. You know, he wasn't going to have anything to do with it. He avoided me like the plague because he knew I wanted to kill him. So I called back and his wife, my ex-wife, his future wife, calls me back and says, hey, you know, Mark will talk to you. I said, oh, okay. And so I knew what happened. She told, in the interim period, she told Mark, says, hey, he's an AA. He's got to do this. He's on this spiritual thing, you know. He's got to say he's sorry to you. And Mark, he got on the phone, and he was a different guy. He was a different guy. He knew that he had me, and he was going to squeeze. And so we made an appointment to meet in the following week at a donut shop. Neither one of us are cops, but, you know, it's a donut shop. But we meet over there, and I sat down across from him, and he had this whole attitude. for the first time, he was looking me right in the eye, and he had this contempt, and I swear he was looking down at me, you know. We were the same height, but I remember I felt like he was looking down at me. I felt little, I felt like he was big, and his neck looked bigger, and, and I start apologizing. I said, "Hey, man, I've been a real asshole." And he goes, "Yeah, you have been." And he goes, I did this. He goes, "Yeah, you did." And, you know, and he was just like that, you know. He was like that. So the whole thing, I go through my whole list. I didn't bring a list like Doug said. I had it all. I knew what all I'd done. So I said it, and he agreed with it all. And I was kind of looking forward to the end of this process because I was thinking, well, when I get done, I get to hear it back from him, you know, what a asshole he is, you know. And it didn't happen. He got all done. And he goes, "Man, you're like the worst asshole I've ever known. You were just like, you know, a horrible person, you know, and blah, blah, blah." And boy, his neck started looking good again. You know, I was really wanting to get that neck again, you know. And I sat there. I took it. You know, I cleaned off my side of the street. I didn't say anything. I went there prepared. My sponsor had prepared me that you know, I was there only to clean off my side of the street. I wasn't there to get any kind of accolades from him, no kind of praise from him. I was there to clean up my side of the street, so I stayed focused on that. It's been 19 something years. I still don't really like the guy, but I he's a long ways away now too. But and they're married. They've been happily married for a long time. But that's what I had to do to get this program. Be willing to go to any lengths. And I want to thank you so much for listening and allowing me to speak on two of my favorite subjects today: spirituality and recovery. And I just want to say God bless everyone. Thank you.
Sure to also thank all of you who were kind enough to write some questions. So we're gonna go through those questions now. All right.
Yeah.
One more. Okay. Gotcha.
If you've got any other questions, we'll take those as well too. But we'll start with this. Okay. I have heard about two different ways to do the 8-9 steps. One is amends for harms only while drinking, and the second is amends for harms your whole life. Which one is correct?
I'm glad you asked the one about financial. Thank you for that. And, I was born saying that an alcohol, and I discovered that the fact that I didn't have an excuse that I was under the influence was really scary and enlightening. So for me personally, I don't think it matters that I was under the influence. What matters is that I was wrong. And a lot of ways I beat myself up for that. Because I wanted an excuse, you know. I was sleepwalking. I was, you know, anything. You know, and I couldn't do that. So it didn't matter. It didn't matter for me. You know, I don't know how it is for the alcoholic addict, but I have to honestly say that in a lot of situations I was sicker than he was.
The way I understand our literature, if we made amends for harm and calm, which says, you know, that the harms we caused while not under the influence were any different than the ones we caused while under the influence, I don't think that's honest.
My opinion.
I think it's the same thing. I think personally I was always an alcoholic or an addict, and it was just a matter of time before the eating was a symptom of a greater illness for me, which is a spiritual condition that I'm using the steps now to remedy. So, you know, if I was 16 and I did something to someone, and, you know, the character defect is my natural instincts gone awry, and that was developing long before I found the first thing that I used to hide that or justify why I used it. And so I think it's all the same thing. Now, I've had to make amends to people that I wasn't using when I did the damage and the harm to these people. But I realized in hindsight that the process of me using started long before the selfishness, the self-centeredness. You know, I was using people at that time, and later it became something else. So I don't really know the difference between the two.
Harms when I was drinking, other harms. So harms are harms. No matter what a man is, no matter what a man is.
All right, thanks. Next question is, I'm not on the ninth step yet, but I really feel I need to make amends with someone close. Can I do this now, and what risks might this present?
Some amends, that's had the knock to its own. Some amends can be done right away, just naturally, especially with people closest. And I've talked about that, and especially the big book. We're going to do some of this stuff, a few things right off the bat. We can't help it. You know, we're living with somebody, and just by getting into the program, starting to try a spiritual life, I mean, we're kind of there. We're going to tell somebody, hey, the people that are close to us, you know, we're going to tell them, hey, we're trying to live a spiritual life, and the meds are going to be in our way of life, you know, our way of living. Of course, like you say, don't leave what you can. Don't run out there and say, I found God, and everything's okay now. My behavior, my behavior, be the best indicator of the truth.
No.
I think when we act differently towards people, that's a form of amends. But the formal amends that is explained in the ninth step is better done when we understand how we harm people. And I think that we don't really have a concept of that without the other steps. Yeah, you know, I would tell women when I would start working with them that we don't realize how we harm people until we do some of the major amends in our 8th and 9th step. And I've always suggested staying out of a relationship, an intimate relationship, until we do some of that work, because we continue to repeat the same behavior without that awareness.
I was so self-righteous and messed up that I didn't know what I was sorry for. And so I did these steps in order. There's no way that I could just jump to 8 and 9. Because I had to take that personal inventory. And I had to work through a lot of issues. And I had a guidance that was offered in a higher power that constantly was telling me, you know, wait, you're not ready. Oh boy, let me show you, you're not ready.
All right, this next question was directed to Danette, but if any of you have a similar outlook, the answers would be useful. Danette says she had a list of people, and one section was never made amends to them. If the step says we must be willing to make amends to all people, how can you have a never call?
I'm a child of an alcoholic, and none of our alcoholics have passed away. And I don't think I'll have an opportunity to make amends, formal amends to him, but to my mother, who was married to him for 50 years. I think that I do make it in, and because, you know, that was her man, you know, and I no longer blame him. I'm no longer a victim, and she didn't change me. And at first, when he passed away, I thought she spoke too well of him. And I had to set her straight. And now that I've made my amends, I really don't have anything but good to say about my father. He did the best he could. That's what he had. So there's some people that are on the never list. And we just learned from our sponsor and our program how to work through that.
When I wrote my column, there were some people I felt like I couldn't forgive and didn't deserve forgiveness. As I worked through the process, I began to see that the forgiveness was for me. The freedom came from me. I wasn't doing this work to allow them something. It really was to release the resentments that I held. There were, and that's not to say that I didn't owe amends for wrongs done. It gave me a freedom to write out those columns. It gave me a starting point. I didn't have to take the whole thing in one giant bite. And what I found was that as I began the process and started doing the work, those people indeed moved over to the later column and then became the, yeah, okay, I'll do it. But I needed the freedom to start there.
Yeah, I agree. They start to move from the never to the maybe to the becoming willing. And my second sponsor used to say, the longer you stay around, there really are no big deals. And things that seem so, you know, this person did this, and I'm never going to forgive this person. You know, the more time you get, it's just not that big of a deal. And, you know, you start to, how can you forgive yourself if you can't forgive someone else? And you start to learn to forgive people. And, you know, I remember specifically some things that had happened. And this is recently, this is one of my more recent times with the steps. And I said, you know, I'm not going to forgive that person. I'm not ready to forgive that person. And he said, you don't have to forgive that person. You have to be willing to forgive that person. And the willingness to do it is what's important. You don't have to do it right now, but you have to be willing to do it. And you may say never, but you're just willing to put them on the list. That's the important thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Oh, chicken neck was on my never list. But, you know, as we stick in here, we become more committed to this, more willing to go to any length, to grow along spiritual lines. The willingness comes. And they become less of a big deal because the goal has changed. Not the goal is not to never make a mess of them. The goal is to go along spiritual lines. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. And next question is, what do I do when the person I need to make amends to won't return my calls? Should I go to his or her house? You have a gun.
Well, the time is important, as was spoken of, and, you know, I mean, I guess there's only just one call, but, I mean, if you're sure they're avoiding you, I would let that go. Things happen the way they're supposed to happen in the right time, and you know, the worst thing you do is have to make an amends for the amends you tried to make, you know, so I've had to do that, you know, and that's it's not fun, so, you know, move on to the next one. There's one behind it, and there's one behind it. And, you know, you cross the ones off you can. So that's all I have to say about that.
Talk to who is your sponsor. There's no pat answer. There are probably particular circumstances that can only be considered on a case-by-case basis.
For me personally, being an Al-Anon, I've been known to have stalker status. Not having recommended, because I always was concerned with who you live, what you do, and why. And the best news I can make is to let it become tiny, let go, let God, and just be willing. So I haven't been knocking down anybody's doors to get to them. And my group of friendship has increased. And I'm really, really working on being a better listener than a preacher. So I like that, Amy.
Yeah, right on. All right. I've heard this in meetings. I put myself at the top of my amends list. Does this seem right to you?
Well, I want to have a conscious contact with God, so really my amends are to Him. That's top of my list. And, you know, the fact that, you know, I let my spirituality stagnate and dissolve over the years, you know, so it's like forgiving Father, or I know not what I do. But anyway, that's first, and then just working through the, you know, the previous steps has already allowed me to forgive myself before I ever get to 89, because I really feel like 89 is people on that list.
My first sponsor did not have me put myself on the list. And the program worked and the transformation took place and I became a woman who didn't need to drink. My second sponsor, as we worked through the steps, asked what harms I had done myself. And at that point, it was useful to take a look at it. So I went to go with what my sponsor suggested. You know, does it need to be? Does it need not to be? My opinion.
Well, I've worked with enough people to know that the right answer is yes. Your name should be on the list. I mean, that's what my sponsors have told me in the past. That this is my third one now. One, I relapsed and had to move on. One, I died. And then the one I'm working with, well, I have four now. The last one just didn't work out as time went on. They've all had me put up myself on there. So I guess it's a, you know, what your sponsor says, really. But my sponsors have all said yes. But I think it's a living amends to yourself. But I can be hard on myself, you know. I missed a lot of days of work for a couple of years. So now I don't like to miss work. So I go to work when I'm sick and I go to work when I'm not right. And so things like that where I'm almost punishing myself for certain things. And that's self-will too. Doing good things sometimes is self-will. Sometimes it seems like the right thing. You know, my sponsor now is big on being good to yourself and making amends to yourself, giving yourself the freedom to take a break, things like that. So I'd say it's a living type of amends. Unless you can forgive yourself, you can't forgive anyone else. It's really, really true. And that's part of going through the steps and learning that and getting back to the first question that was asked. And it's hard to make an amends to someone else when you haven't really acknowledged what's going on with you. So.
Person wrote this, I've heard this in meetings, I put myself at the top of my man's list. That seems right to you? Then in parentheses it says, seems like crap to me. You know, my first year, very much in particular, my first year, whenever I had a question, when I would hear different points of view, I always took it to my sponsor. My sponsor was the guy that sorted it out for me. Because there's people in coming from a lot of different angles of things, you know, and I'm not hearing maybe what they're saying, you know, my perception of things. And so my sponsor was always able to, he had a fair amount of time, he was always able to explain what, you know, what I needed to do in terms of, or what they meant, or how it works. And personally, I didn't put myself on my list
I don't remember doing that, and but as I learn to forgive other people, which is not wasn't in my natural state. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't somebody that naturally was very forgiving. You know, I held resentments. You know, a lot of judgment. And as I learned to forgive, I became to feel forgiven. You know, I was okay with me. You know, and you know, and the best amends that I've ever done for myself. But now I look at it differently than I did back then. But now I look at how I did amends for myself, and that was, you know, doing these steps. You know, letting go of that old destructive way of life where I was creating all this immense amount of wreckage and hate and resentment, stepping on everybody's toes in conflict with everybody and everything. You know, that I quit doing, and that was the best thing I did for myself. But now, you know, I feel like a person living in a lot more harmonious state with other people. And that feels good. And, you know, and the thing is, if you stay sober, you do this program, you get to where you like yourself. You get to where you love yourself. You know, it will just naturally happen. Thank you.
All right, thank you. You know, one of the things that we do here is we bring together people who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body from a number of different afflictions, be drugs or alcohol or trying to control other people. And one of the questions that always swirls around this particular event is the concept of traditions. And I think this next question really kind of highlights that. So. Is it a good idea for a drug addict to ask an alcoholic to be their sponsor?
Is it a good idea for a man to sponsor a woman? You know, it's a good idea for a lot of stuff. I don't know, but I sponsored a lot of drug addicts. I'm a drug addict, though, also. So by the time I got here, I was I quit drinking a year before I got here. I don't count that year of sobriety because I was still medicating myself with the other stuff, you know. But I have some opinions about that that go contrary to a lot of other people's opinions. You know, I believe it's okay. You know, if that alcoholic and that addict relate to each other, and they're going to do the same exact steps. And the only place it mentions alcohol in 12 steps is in the first step, and the rest of it's all the same. So that's my opinion, and it's probably contrary to somebody else's opinion.
Yeah, it's going to be contrary because you have to do the steps that's in the program you're working. You know, there's a guy, and I love him to death. And I know he does his own meetings, and he's working with people, and it works for him. But he couldn't identify himself as an addict in AA meeting, so he'd go to NA meeting. But he would raise the alcoholic text as the text he works out of. And we would go round and around that this was not right, you know. You can't, you know, use this text for this meeting and there's traditions. And, you know, I think the general rule of thumb is if you're in an AA meeting, then, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you need to find someone who's an alcoholic. If you're an addict, you need to find someone who's an addict, really. I think I just, you know, it comes down to traditions and representing what goes on in that meeting. And, you know, it was a big question for me, and this is a really hits home to me because I recently started Al-Anon. I've been going for about 4 months now. And do I get an Al-Anon sponsor, you know? I mean, I don't want to have more than one sponsor, right? Do I get an alcohol sponsor, an NA sponsor, an Al-Anon sponsor? But I did have to get an Al-Anon sponsor because my NA sponsor can't help me work the steps the Al-Anon way. So you have to have a sponsor that's going to help you work the program that you're having the problems with. And if you're an alcoholic, that's the AA way. How would an alcoholic know how to work them out of the NA step working guide? And if you go to NA meetings, then you would, why would you ask an alcoholic to be your sponsor because you should be working out of the step working guide? To me, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, a lot of us are dual addicted, so it's different. You know, when I do a little bit of both traditions, I mean, both programs when I work the steps, so it's tough, but you look at that AA purist, I was going to say, it's going to work in the AA way. You know, they don't even see if you even take a drug, they don't really consider you relapsing. So why would you work at the NA way with an alcoholic? So, Yeah, I would say you really need to find a sponsor for what you are afflicted with or feel you are at that time.
This program works because we identify with each other. If we have it, then we've got it to share. One alcoholic helping another, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is based on. It's not based on some psychological textbook kind of college degree stuff. It's the process of identification. I did that when you did that. This is what I did to get better. If you want what I've got, do what I've done. So I think that without that process of identification, a bond can't be formed that will allow someone to walk through the steps.
When I first came to Al-Anon, there were not enough sponsors. And it took me 3-4 years and to try to get someone to help me work through these steps. And when I finally did get somebody, because I mean, I had temporaries that I didn't complete them, and when I finally did get someone, I said, "Who was your sponsor?" And she said, "A man from AA." And I thought, "Oh, that's great." I mean, Lois, very typical W. You know, we're codependents, so naturally we're going to steal whatever you're going to sell. It works when you work it, so whatever's going to, you know, when you're desperate and you're ready, the teacher will come.
I think we're definite maybe there. I'm going to paraphrase this next question just a little bit. There was some discussion about how we might be overcome by emotions and how they put us on the defense when dealing with mimicking these events. And so the question is, are there any suggestions that you can offer on how you could overcome when your emotions might put you in a defensive stature against doing this work?
Well, I had to do the slogan and keep it simple. Less words was better. And I had to role play with my sponsor. That was fun. We got into character. We pretended. I had practice. And, you know, or practice with a mirror or whatever it took to be able to say, "I was wrong. I'm sorry, I won't do it again." And that's what I did. And prayed a lot that God would give me the timing and the words.
I tried very hard when I got here to overcome self-will with self-will. And I really had to have a higher balance.
I agree with keeping it simple and praying before you do it, and just to add to that, to make a commitment to actually do it no matter what when you say you're going to do it. And for me, the example was my father. We went to see a Laker game, and I prayed on it, went over it, and I knew that I was going to do it down there, and it was a time, and the time's not right, and to stop and start, and finally I just said I'm going to have to do it, but to commit to doing it, you're going to do it, and try to make the time as right as possible, but to do it.
All right, we got something we all agree on. Keep it simple. Okay. All right. Next question is, with regards to making amends, I've heard not to start off with saying "I'm sorry," but rather say "I was wrong." Perhaps say you're sorry after you admitted you were wrong. Do you have any suggestions on this?
You know, as I was saying earlier, there's only like 8 pages in the Big Book about this, and only 10 small pages in 12 and 12. They're not trying to lay down exactly what they do every particular incident. You know? So it's general principles. You know? Sorry, wrong. Wrong is a good word. It implies a different meaning than sorry. And I think I need to go in there and let people know that I was wrong about what I did. You know, sorry, I'm sorry I was caught. You know, I'm sorry you got mad at me for what I did to you. You know, that's, you know, sorry is kind of a different kind of word. We are saying we're sorry when we say we're wrong.
I didn't make that more confused. It's nice to have a perspective sometimes from being in the Al-Anon program and to live with someone who's also an addict. So when I hear I'm sorry, that's what my wife says after she wrecks the car. No, I don't necessarily want to hear that when she's making an amends. But that being said, when she has made the amends and said, I was wrong for my behavior and it won't happen again, and then she finishes, I'm sorry. That's okay, but just don't, in my opinion, say, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry is something, you know, we've said over and over and over. I'm sorry I blew the money. I'm sorry I did this. I'm sorry I treated the kids bad. And so sorry is just a red flag that's coming up, and it's probably going to make the amends tougher, in my opinion.
If I understand the question correctly, what I would do is to say I was wrong to do this, and then I say what I did, and I was wrong to do that, and I say what I did, and I say I regret the harms I caused. I think it's a much stronger statement than sorry. And we've been sorry all our lives. I think.
When you hear I'm sorry first, I'm sorry I'm wrong, it's kind of like, I'm sorry I got caught. But, you know, so pretty much what you said, just being able to confess, you know, what the harm was and lay it out there on the table, identify it, claim it, own it, and really mean it. And that really comes with time. Because a lot of people have been hurt and have had broken promises. And so what they're confessing now isn't necessarily going to be taken to heart. And so, but if you get the ball rolling, I'll tell you that. And saying you make an end holds you accountable. And that's exactly what I needed.
All right, and then our last question, which is, do you put a time frame on steps 8 and 9, how long should this take?
Okay, I had a pretty long list, and I had to do a lot of praying and preparation individual every day, in my pocket shirt, every day, I set a little thumb for each one of them, and eventually, you know, it humbled my heart and prepared me. And I don't think if I didn't make a daily conscious effort and I slacked or I skipped days, it wouldn't have worked for me. But I won. And I got it for the first couple of weeks. And I begged my sponsor, can we just get it? And she said, no, because I can tell by the tone of your voice and your attitude, you are not ready. So, it was a process, and it took a while for me.
Well, in the beginning, I would suggest one a week. Write one out, bring it, we'll go over it, take a look at it. And then as it got down to some of the amends that weren't as major, I would suggest they wrote them out and hold themselves in willingness, unless a letter or something indicated it's a case by case. And as far as a time frame, I've never said we're going to have every name off this list in, you know, 2 months, that's it. But what I have done is move people, sponsees, on into step 10 and start doing that daily inventory and continuing to move on through the steps as the amends are worked. I think it, to just stay there if the list is long and not to proceed with the rest of the program is not as beneficial.
So yeah, this is a definitive answer to finish up on, is that you're never done with that step ever. You know, I mean, you're going to go on to step 10 while you're still doing amends, and you're going to add people to the list. People are going to come up you didn't even know you had, and some are going to be ready to, some you're not going to do right away. But the reason why you can definitively say that you're never going to be done with this is because it's a living amends. You change behavior on a daily basis and make sure you don't do it again. You'll be doing that for the rest of your life. So you're essentially always on step 9.
I think those are all really good and valid points. And certainly, there's certain amends that had to drag on. I guess all the financial amends took me 10 years to get those completely done. Some amends I got done right away. It's very, very good to have a sponsor and to have a good, solid program based on the 12 steps to help guide you in this and your personal quest. And I just mentioned the founders of AA, Dr. Bob and W.W., they jumped right on this stuff. And if you read the story about Dr. Bob and the back of Dr. Bob's nightmare, it's a very interesting story. The day that he got, the day after he got sober, he got in his car and he went out and he made amends all over town. It's like day one. Day one. He went off and he didn't come back till like midnight that night. It tells the story. You know, he went out and saw everybody that he could right away. You know. So, Bill read in the beginning, there's many ways, there are people, there are many, that's how many ways there are to do this in a sense. But the 12 steps are guiding principles. Thank you.
All right. Please help me thank our panelists today.